Blog Talk Radio.
You are now online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.
Welcome. You are now online with Andrea. I am your host, Andrea Garrison, here on Blog Talk Radio. And whether you're on the phone line, on the internet, on a podcast, listening, chatting, blogging, listening to us live or reviewing one of our archives, we are so happy to have you with us. For those of you who'd like to call in, we may open up the phone lines later in the show. The call-in number is 347-426-3895. And for those of you who'd like to chat, please feel free to join our chat room. It is open, but you must be registered with Blog Talk to chat in our chat room. Tonight, our topic is the wonderful book called Optimism, Cultivating the Magic, quality that can extend your lifespan, boost your energy, and make you very happy now. How's that? Our guests are the editors, Dawson Church and Stephanie Marone, and we also have a few of the contributors to the book who'll be calling in as well. I love that. Optimism, cultivating the magic quality that can extend your lifespan, boost your energy, and make you happy now. How are you, Dawson and Stephanie?
Great, and it's fabulous to be here, Andrea. Thank you.
Yeah.
And, Andrea, I'm so happy to be on with you again. And I think you should get Dawson to tell how he came up with that title, because that title was his.
Yeah, you know, I was so excited when I saw that. I said, we need some optimism. And so I think it's wonderful. So you got to tell me what inspired you to do the book on optimism. And then, yes, how did you come up with the title?
Well, here's how it happened, and you'll get a good chuckle out of this, Andrea. It was the depths of the recession. Lehman Brothers had gone belly up, taking with it AIG. There was furious political controversy about the TARP bailout plan. People were sunk in doom and gloom as all the economic indicators just were going way down. And one stock trader was asked what stock position he was in, and his response was the fetal position. I'm just here huddled in the corner of my office in Wall Street, wondering whether to jump out the window or not. So there was all this bad news, and Stephanie and I had worked on several other anthologies before, and we were talking about what the next one might be. And I thought, well, how about one on optimism? And when I told people we were doing an anthology on optimism, they just cracked up. We'd done ones before on topics like audacious aging and peak vitality and all these uplifting themes. But to do one on optimism at the height of pessimism was just outrageous. But
we
put out the call, we had this vision, and these wonderful contributors responded with some of the most fantastic, inspiring pieces. So it's just that necessity of not being sucked into the mindset of the culture, the prevailing wisdom around you, staking your claim for your highest vision, your highest sense of possibilities, and not letting go of that when all of the drumbeats around you are in the opposite direction.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful. I want to read a little bit of page 7, which is your introduction, Stephanie.
Yes. What are you going to pull out of there, Andrea?
I loved it, though. What a powerful opening, don't you think, Dawson?
Yes, absolutely.
It says, some people consider optimism to be unrealistic in these times of planetary crisis, but pessimism does not equal realism, and research has shown for decades that our thoughts and beliefs have a great effect on what actually happens in our lives. we can go back to the early sociological findings on the effects of negative self-image and the negative projections of teachers and other authority figures on the future prospects of youth. Self-fulfilling prophecy has been well demonstrated. We can also turn to research on the reverse relationship of beliefs and behavior. That is, that attitudes follow behavior, that by behaving as if we can instill belief, combining the evidence of these two lines of research tells us that if we behave as if we humans will be able to solve the serious problems facing us, we will more likely be able to. There is no evidence to support a positive outcome from behaving as if we are unlikely to be able to solve the problems. It's important to note here that optimism is not merely hope. It is reflected in action as much as in thinking. Optimists don't just sit back and wait for things to get better. Their behavior reflects their positive attitude. In fact, it is more likely that it is the pessimist who will do nothing, believing that there is no point. It is also worth noting that it takes a lot more effort in these dire times to be an optimist, to keep from succumbing to the negativity that is all around us. What a wonderful opening.
Thank you so much. And, you know, it's funny, after doing this book, I started seeing all these T-shirts, bumper stickers about pessimism and optimism, and they're really quite funny. The idea that the pessimist says, oh, don't worry, it won't work out, the variations on that theme, and how the optimist has a very opposite approach, which many people are making jokes about. But I feel that, first of all, after the part that you read, I go on to talk about some of the research about optimism and pessimism. And if the rest of this doesn't persuade you to go with an optimistic attitude, you can simply consider your health, because there's all this research to show that optimists actually live longer, have a much greater likelihood of recovering from a heart surgery. Cardiovascular disease is less likely, or more likely if you're a pessimist, to not do well and suffer from that. But what I noticed when I was looking over the research again today to refresh my memory, I noticed all the research, or most of it, was heart-related, so heart disease. So I love this idea that optimism is about a lighter heart. A more open heart, you know, that there's this free-flowing energy and that it's reflected in diseases of the heart if you don't have that kind of attitude in your life.
Yeah, it's like a mind over matter. You know, it's like if you can believe it, you know, it'll happen.
Yes.
And it's so much, you know, and it's interesting that you talk about health, because, like you said, the patient who believes they'll get better will get better.
Well,
you know?
I don't even know that it's that direct, because they may not even be thinking about that aspect of things, because it's even people developing cardiovascular disease. So they might not be even walking around thinking, I'm not going to get cardiovascular disease.
Right.
They're just living their lives, and
right.
yet they live longer. They have a lower rate of disease of all kinds. It's really something. And then I think we need to add, when I was putting the anthology together, I came across, I really felt like I needed to honor our kind of ancestors of optimism, the ones that have given, that started this whole movement as it is today.
Right.
And there are a number of luminaries that have done that, but I think that we really need to point to, there was an essay written by Helen Keller called Optimism. Now, if Helen Keller can be optimistic,
right,
the rest of us don't have a single excuse not to be.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That was beautiful. All of the essays are absolutely beautiful. And, yeah, she was so positive and so full of light. And it's beautiful that you included her.
Her essay is so inspiring to me. I hadn't read it before. I didn't even know she had written an essay on optimism. And it's actually in three parts. It's quite lengthy. And I just pulled out one of the parts, but it's really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, it is beautiful. And so how did you go about determining who would be in this book? And if you could also reflect on some of the people who are featured in the book, like Helen Keller, for example.
Dawson, should I answer that?
Yes, by all means.
The way that I've done it with previous anthologies that Dawson and I have worked with, we come up with a list together of kind of our dream list, and there'll be various names on it, celebrities and other people, and I mean less well-known is what I mean. We have a whole attitude towards these anthologies that we really don't want to just have the usual suspects. We want to also include very valuable voices of those who are not necessarily household names but have a lot to say. So
right.
we do a combination in our anthologies, and I think it's a really important formula because there are, I mean, I'm just amazed at the people that I meet, and I put meet in quotes because it's usually by phone, in the course of doing these books. And many of them are joining us here today, quite incredible people. Our dream list included many of the people that are in here, in terms of luminaries, and then I began looking, you know, I had an idea of what other fields I wanted to hear from. So it's kind of creating this holistic picture that covers all these different areas of walks of life. So wanted to make sure that we have a scientist or two, that we have an artist or two, that we have someone in entertainment, that we have a writer, that we have an inspirational thinker, a visionary of other kinds. So that's kind of that's the path I follow when I do it, and I find in working on these anthologies that I'm just led from one to the other, and it becomes this very organic process of who's supposed to be in the book.
Yeah, and you know, the Helen Keller, the title of hers is Optimism Within.
Yeah, that's one of the three sections of her optimism essay, and that's the original title.
Mm-hmm. I love the title of that, too. It's very powerful. Optimism Within. You know, because sometimes people will smile on the outside, but inside, you know, to have that optimism right to the core is a whole other thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and she certainly, she devoted one-third of her essay to that topic, and that's exactly what she was talking about, that it could not depend on externals, especially in her case.
Right, that you had to go deep within.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And then I relied on, go ahead. I was going to say, and then I relied on Dawson for the science, which to me is quite fascinating. So maybe you might want to get him to talk about that, because it lays the groundwork for what this is all about.
Yeah,
yeah,
please.
Stephanie quotes three studies in her introduction to the book, and I've been collecting research for the last 5 years on the link, especially between genetics and happiness. And we find that when people are optimistic, are happy, are joyful, have a positive disposition toward life, that this really affects their bodies. It affects their stress levels. It affects their production of hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. But it affects them way down to the level of the genes. In one piece of research, they found that men who had a habit of laughing heartily had over 25 genes that were expressed differently after that hearty laugh than men who weren't disposed to laughter. And throughout research, you find, whether you're looking at research on AIDS patients, cardiac patients, cancer patients, wherever you look, you find studies showing that positivity generally has an enormous effect on health. And I'm not just talking about 6 months or a year of extra life or a better health span. I'm talking, if you look at the cumulative evidence of at least a decade of additional lifespan and health span as a result of a positive attitude. So we realize that optimism is one of the things you can do. And, you know, if you might have the perfect nutritional regimen, you might lead a really healthy lifestyle, you might eat organic food, watch everything you do. And if in your mind you are still being crippled by self-doubt, negative self-talk, core beliefs that don't support your having a good life, a negative view of the universe. There's research now showing that people who have a negative view of God or the universe or a higher power, whatever, who believe that the universe is out there to get them, they live in a punishing universe, have shorter health spans and more disease than people who believe in a positive universe, a benevolent universe. So there's just the research is overwhelming, literally hundreds and hundreds of studies, all arguing for the health effects of a positive outlook.
Yeah. I mean, it really is a beautiful project, and it must have been amazing to work on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But I have to say, Dawson, I don't know what you remember about this, but when you first brought the project to me, do you remember my reaction? That
are you nuts? Oh, people think I'm nuts. This was a really, really, really great start to a project. So I know I'm on the right track.
Okay, now I want everybody who's listening to listen to that laugh.
I see. Oh, so that's why you did the research on that hearty laugh.
No, it was very funny because Dawson brought this project to me, and I found myself going into this pessimistic place about it. I said, "Oh, clearly."
I said, "Clearly,
I need to do this book. I have a problem." It was funny, and it really, in the course of the book, I mean, I thought that I had pessimism beat, so to speak, but I realized that, there was more work to do, and it was quite thrilling to put together this combination of contributors, because in editing their chapters, it was like mini tutorials in optimism. It was fantastic. So I came out with all the pieces fully in place.
I know. Imagine, you know, you're kind of like in a low mood, you know, feeling very pessimistic, and then you're like reading like hundreds of essays on optimism and what that does for you, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think we have Janine Talty on the line. Let's see. I believe I see. Janine, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Glad to speak to you again,
Andrea. I know you are.
Hi, Janine. It's Stephanie.
Hi. Oh, Janine.
And Dawson. Good to see you guys. Even though I can't.
Wonderful to hear your voice.
Yeah, it is wonderful. And you are the optimist. We've spoken before, and you're just so upbeat and positive and wonderful.
Well, it comes from a life experience of really having the opportunity to choose. And overcome, you know, great obstacles, and to be able to help others, you know, change their perception, as Dawson was just saying. You know, you have that choice, and you're being a physician. You're you know, teaching others that their physical well-being has everything to do with their attitude.
And
they can, you know, it's amazing how many people come feeling broken, and just by having them look through a different lens, how it changes their life.
It's amazing how, you know, we were just laughing, you know, and I was thinking about how healing laughter is. It's just a wonderful thing.
And Dawson can teach us that. He has the best laugh of anybody I think I have ever heard.
He's
a joy to laugh with.
When I was a kid, I noticed how some people laugh deeply, heartily, from their core. Others laugh at the top of their throat and lightly, just a small sort of, you know, chuckle. And I thought, why not learn to experience life and delve into life and resonate with life so deeply that laughter comes from your core. So my daughter, Angela, said for years I should put my laughter on my website, and eventually I did. I was just amazed to discover last month it's gone viral, and people are emailing my laugh all over the planet.
Laughing along with it.
Well, you know what you could do now? You could do another book on laughter.
And we'd have to it brings to mind to me that that song and scene in Mary Poppins, I Love to Laugh, where Dick Van Dyke is giving all the different laughs that people do.
Right.
And then there's the one who has the hearty laugh that just rises to the ceiling and can't stop laughing. And it's just infectious watching that scene. I don't know if you recall that, if you've seen it. But it's listening to Dawson laugh, and I've gone on his website and listened to his laugh on there, and it just makes me laugh every time.
Oh, I have to go there because I love laughing. I really do enjoy it. So, Janine, tell us, what did you think when you heard about this project on optimism?
Very much a little bit, I think, like Stephanie. I really had no idea what to do with it. And I remember kind of mulling it over, and I mentioned it to a patient I was treating, like, the next day. And somebody who I had been seeing for 10 years. And I asked him, I said, you know, what do you think I know about optimism? And he turned to me and he looked in my eye with a look in his that was absolutely chilling. And he said, and I quote, "I am here today because of your optimism."
Ah.
And I shuddered. Mm. I'm like, whoa, you know.
Mm.
So I don't know if we really even are aware of how much we can affect others in our just believing, you know, that better things can come, and they do. That whole, you know, law of attraction. Pay attention to what it is that we're keeping in our intention, you know, whether it's positive or negative. And if you choose a positive outlook, guess what happens? Things come.
Yeah. So how do you keep the optimism at the forefront during challenging times? How do you do it?
What I do is I kind of fall back into this place of a grander scheme, you know, thinking that we can easily get lost in the details of life.
Right.
And the drudgery and putting one foot in front of the other. And sometimes when I get in that space, I look at myself and I think, you know, I'm taking this way too seriously, because in the end game, nothing really matters. You know, life goes on, and the little details that we get so drawn into, you know, how much of that are we going to remember a year from now, 2 years from now?
Mm.
That's not the point. The point is, you know, are we doing what we came to do? Are we contributing? Are we giving back? Are we helping others day to day, you know, deal with what they have to deal with? These are challenging times. I don't have to remind anybody, you know, who's listening. I mean, this is really the big dance. This is tough. And if we get lost in the drama, we lose our energy to it. But if we have the ability to step back, look at the big picture and say, you know, it is what it is for right now, and I'm going to choose to look forward and do the best I can and do the best I can for others.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I also think that the key to all of that is faith. Because it's so easy to, as I said in my introduction, it's so much easier to go into pessimism. And the great religions of the world, and including all the mystical traditions, all of them say our job as humans is not to despair. And so it takes great strength and faith in the midst of global crisis and personal crisis. There's a lot of people going through very rough times right now.
Yeah.
And as many people have been around the world for a long time, but the United States is feeling it particularly now, with people's homes being foreclosed on, people losing their jobs, and it's a lot of personal crisis in the midst of the larger crisis. And I think these are the times that try human souls, that it's really hard to maintain your faith in the midst of all of that, but that really is our job.
Yeah, if we can all chip in and do what we can, you know, to give light to others, you know, a smile or just, you know, just be kind, something, to show them that there is hope, you know, to keep going, to just hang in there and don't give up. It's so important, right?
It is. And one thing that's worth noting, too, is the importance of cultivating optimism even when you don't feel like it or you aren't drawn to it. In the essay I wrote about the whole idea that you can see something, perceive something, once you develop the neurological wiring to perceive it. But until you perceive it, you can't. And I give lots of examples from science how until you look for a phenomenon, you don't see it. But when you start looking for a phenomenon, suddenly you see it all over the place. And so you need to actually cultivate the propensity, the ability to tune in to that kind of energy, to become optimistic. And when you do that, suddenly it is something that you're attuned to, you notice, you see all around you. But until you do that, until you deliberately cultivate that neural wiring, you can't see it. Someone can be giving you a fantastic gift right before your eyes, and you just can't see it because you haven't built the neural capacity to perceive that. But once you have built the neural capacity, just like a wine connoisseur can appreciate wine, or a music critic can really spot the differences between two pieces of music played by different people, once you've developed the neural network to perceive those phenomena, you see them readily. So I talk a lot about the need to actually deliberately cultivate an optimistic attitude and energy in your life.
Yeah, I guess it's important to be present, isn't it? You know, to not worry about the past and focus on the future, to find the beauty in the moment. Do you think that helps to keep...
It does. And also, whatever you can do to release stress is more able to allow you to do that, because when you're stressed, stress recruits an enormous number of biological resources. Stress recruits your nervous system, your central nervous system, your peripheral nervous system. Your whole nervous system is grabbed when you're under stress, and all of the mantras you've chanted, all of the workshops you've done, all of the inspirational books you've read, those have very little power to help your behavior when you're stressed. When you're stressed, you revert to that basic fight or flight level, and when you're in that level, all of the inspirational sayings you wanted to practice and the inspirational emails you've read, the classes you've taken, those things all go out the window. So de-stressing ourselves is the first step. When you're stressed, biologically, you're pretty much incapable of choosing your response. You're just driven by that stress. So de-stressing yourself is the first step. After that, you can make use of the other tools.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really is a beautiful project. I think we have Susan Russell. Are you there? I know you're on mute. You were early.
Yes, I wanted to enjoy the whole show.
I know. Well, feel free to join in. If you could share with us, what was your reaction when you heard about this book on optimism? What was your first reaction?
I think I had a double reaction. I had the left brain and the right brain reaction, and one was I thought it was a great project and very timely, and then I also went through the, wow, what am I going to put together that speaks to that? So I had an awareness that both of those sides were talking simultaneously.
So why do you think it's so important for people to be optimistic?
Because the only way something new can come in beyond what's already programmed into your experience and the experience of the DNA from our ancestors is to be open to something new. Otherwise, we always default to the pre-recorded program.
And I just wanted to insert here that the title of Susan's chapter in the book is The Positive Reflections of the Illness Mirror. And I would love it if you would tell the listeners, because I think this is your point was so important. Talk about your model a little bit, Susan.
Okay, well, the illness mirror really arose from work with clients where I had worked with sometimes family members or couples. And in working with them in separate rooms where they were not aware of what the work was going on, I would work on one person and the other one responded. Work on the other person, and the other person responded. So what I began to see was a pattern of people sharing information, and so often we're taught that if you have a cold, it's your cold. If you have a headache, it's yours. And one of my larger or more pronounced situations was a situation between a parent and a child, and the child was brought in for schizophrenia. And I was not able to directly work with that child because of the tending of voices and pacing. So I suggested the parent, they had driven over two hours to see me, they might want to relax, and I did some acupuncture on them. And the pattern I chose is called ghost gate points. And in Chinese medicine, they're very aware that we can have attaching energy or information that's not ours, and it jams in the circuits. So I was really working on sort of calming down the parent who was noticeably, and as Dawson speaks to having an increased awareness, I could feel that her whole energy system was extremely chaotic. And in doing this pattern, her child calmed down. I went outside and was able to, after 20 minutes, have a full conversation with this person. They told me of their life dreams and aspirations, what college they wanted to go to, everything. Absolutely exhibited no signs of schizophrenia whatsoever. So I actually began to work with the parent and then the child, and wound up unentangling the way they had cross-linked information. And this person went on to graduate high school and go on to college and was able to actually have a complete life experience. And this was completely counter to my earlier training, which was in the traditional psych ward, where when we received a person who was mentally ill or depressed or going through whatever, we were taking care of that person directly for the illness. Now, often after we had a family session, we would call that person the identified patient, because it was revealed in the family session that the family was extremely disordered and this person was simply the sensitive one manifesting everything. And while they didn't talk about energies in that unit, there was a recognition that from a psychodynamic perspective that a sensitive person could be mirroring a lot of the unresolved issues of the family unit. So in doing the, you know, the acupuncture and other energy work, I just saw this over and over again, from anything as mild as a depression to as large as the schizophrenia, where these things resolve, but they resolve virtually by working through another person.
What about the what about physical conditions?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We've had you know, stomach aches and headaches, and I had a little girl I worked with, and she was constantly getting stomach aches. And it was always in a certain class, and I had her visualize the class, and I turned out to be one of the classmates. So desensitized this child to that person, and they stopped having the stomach aches.
Wow, that's something. So both of you, you and Janine, have to be optimistic even in your work every day.
Yes. You have to bring the wherewithal that you're going to be open to picking up exactly what's going on with the person, but then also open to what's going to balance that person. Because, you know, a lot of times we think we have to know everything, but when you're really standing in the field of that person's, you know, energy system, all the information is there. And so being sensitive enough to pick that up and trusting enough of the information to act on it, I know. I don't know if this was Janine's experience, but with mine in the very beginning, sometimes I was a little resistant. So one of my earlier situations was a person who came in with this horrible backache. And all situations I talk about, I do have people's permission to do so. She could barely walk, and when she came in, you know, just settled her down, and I said, okay, what's going on? And I got the information of orange, green, and purple. And I was like, I am not going to tell this person orange, green, and purple. So this doesn't mean anything. Tap back in, and I kept getting orange, green, purple, orange, green, purple. So I finally said to the person, does orange, green, purple mean anything to you? Burst into tears. They were a childhood memory. They were the lights that were in the room at the time that a trauma occurred. And the backache resolved upon resolving that trauma memory. So after that, I really began to just follow the information. regardless of how disjuncted it was for me, it always, when presented to the person, has meaning.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Not to interrupt. Where do you perceive that from in your own system?
You know, it is different with each person. So sometimes I'm getting a visual movie. Other times I'm seeing the energetic around them like a patch there. And sometimes it's auditory, and on a rare occasion it's actually olfactory information.
Interesting.
I might get a smell of, you know, mold or cinnamon or whatever, and that may have something to do with that person's issue, and just by presenting it to them, because I always want to have them tie back to it instead of me just being the one telling them what's going on. I want to help them reconnect to their own source of information about themselves, and then plug into the fact that they can, with their optimism, find that solution instead of maybe getting stuck in the fear.
Yeah, that's amazing work.
One of the things I wanted to kind of share was, you know, we were talking about staying in the optimistic side or in the pessimistic side.
Right.
And with that, a lot of times when people are trying to hold the optimistic view, your system is discarding what is the pessimistic view in front of it. So people will often experience more chaos while they're trying to stay optimistic. And just for them to know that that's normal, it's almost like the wake that's formed when a boat is crossing water. You're cutting through something new, but you're displacing old patterns, because a lot of times we think what we're experiencing was actually created today.
Right.
Often was something that was brewing a week, 2 weeks ago, or even a year ago, especially if people are holding on to negative thoughts about a person or an event.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Just to give them optimism.
Yeah, it's so important to just let things go, isn't it? And
yeah.
Not hold on to things.
Right, because then that stagnates any possibility, new possibility from coming in, almost like two people holding an opposite side of the door, one person pushing against it and one person trying to open it. And nothing happens because each person is using all their force on either side. And yet if one of them walks away, then the door will usually move.
Right. It does, you know, it seems like when you're really in a positive mood, sometimes it seems like the forces are against you and you have to keep plugging through and saying, you know, I'm not going to let this happen. I'm going to hang in there and I'm going to stay positive. It's almost like you have to keep, you know, reinforcing it and telling yourself, I'm not going to let it get me down. I'm going to keep going. You have to do that, right?
Yes.
And we have to keep in mind that it's all energy. You know, it's all transference of energy from us to others, to what surrounds us. And when you think about it in terms like that, you know, it's information. But it's also bringing in a certain vibration of energy that is pure and unadulterated. And if you can bring that in through your own system with the awareness that I know Dawson has, I am hearing that Susan has, and I'm sure Stephanie, that if you can learn to command that and to bring it in volitionally, that is really kind of what can be transported, you know, into a space or into a situation.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I have, you know, over the years I've told people that sometimes even if I feel down about one thing, I can always find something to be happy about. So what I do is I focus on the thing that makes me happy. And then people say, well, then aren't you being fake? You know, you're being false. You're pretending to be happy, but you're not. I say, but no. I am sad about this. Or, you know, I find this to be disturbing. But I'm happy about this. And I just choose to be happy rather than focus on that. It doesn't mean that I'm not feeling the sadness. It's just that I'm focusing more on the joy.
Well, I also think there's something about needing to remove certain things from your energy field, from one's energy field, because the part about, I mean, we all would like to live in the present and the be here now kind of approach to life. But until we really clear the traumas of our past from our energy field, I think it's hard going to keep, to stay in the present, to stay positive, to be optimistic, to be happy. I'm able to say in my own life that I came to the point of not only the glass half full but overflowing. The reason why is because I feel that I cleared so much out of my energy field, so I am not being driven by the things in my energy field that were keeping, you know, Dawson, you mentioned the neuronal pathways, that were keeping the tracks in my brain, you know, keeping my mind traveling along the same tracks in my brain that were detrimental to me and were driven by, I believe, by what was in my energy field. So these are, you know, that's where the traumas are stored. And Robert Scare did this research on his model is that each trauma that we ever experience is stored in a trauma capsule in our energy field, and there's leaks in those capsules, and that's what can drive us and keep us from being able to be happy, to be optimistic, to experience the magical quality of life. And yes, you can retrain your mind, but I also believe that the energy field, that you must clear the energy field.
So how do you do that? How do you clear it?
Well, I use a number of techniques, and I'm going to turn over the discussion of EFT to Dawson, but I have been using energy clearing techniques. EFT is one of them. Dawson can talk more about that. Seamorg matrix work is the old name for the one that was really great for me, and its new name is Advanced Integrative Therapy. People can look that up online. It's quite exceptional. It works with the chakras. So however you work with the energy field, in the case of EFT, it's the acupressure points. But Dawson, why don't you talk about EFT?
Sure. EFT is used to clear emotional trauma by having you recall the trauma vividly. So you think back to the traumatic event or events. And normally, of course, we do the opposite. We try and suppress them. We try and dissociate. We try and keep them at arm's length so that they don't, that trauma capsule doesn't break open and affect our lives. When we're young kids, the idea of wrapping your traumatic experiences in a capsule and burying it in the subconscious, burying it in your muscle memory, that really makes sense. If you're 2 years old, if you're 5 years old, if you're being bullied or abused, you have no ability to deal with that cognitively. So the smartest thing to do is what we do, which is pop it in, push it in a capsule, push it into the subconscious, store it in our bodies, and then it stays there to be processed later. What EFT does is have you actually dig up that old trauma capsule, remember that vividly, and while you're really in the trauma capsule, while you're really thinking about that experience vividly, you then rub or tap 12 acupressure points. And the combination of the stimulus from your memory, which, of course, is driving you into a stress response, into fight or flight, so you're accustomed to going into fight or flight when you think about this memory, but you then counter-condition that memory using the tapping. So your body is getting a second confounding signal, a second signal that says you're safe, because if you really were in a dangerous situation, you wouldn't be tapping. So the tapping sends a second signal to your body saying, hey, don't worry, no need to associate that traumatic memory with going into fight or flight. And once that stress response, once that conditioned response is broken one time, it tends to stay broken. And all of these energy therapies, whether it's Yin Energy Medicine, whether it's Seamorg Matrix or Advanced Energy Therapy, EFT, EMDR, they all are working at this energy level of these memories, and they're phenomenally fast. They're much faster than just talking about the old experience, which tends to reinforce it. So I use EFT a lot because it's super simple to learn. It's really safe. It's used by about 10 million people worldwide. It's very popular. But there are lots of other therapies which have the same effect. So the ones that some of the other guests are talking about really have similar effects to EFT as well.
And we should also add there that though we put these memories in a capsule, it's not contained and forever separated from us. It definitely informs how we're living now, because we get triggered in present day by something that is reminiscent of what's in that capsule. So I really felt that before I did all this energy work, I didn't even realize how many times or that I was being triggered. And so my response to the present was not a response to the present. It was a response to the past.
Yes, and in fact, during our EFT workshops, I always say the problem is never the problem. So someone presents and they say, okay, the problem is my boss or my colleague, and here's how he's the problem, and they go on to describe his behavior. I completely ignore the wife, the husband, the colleague, the boss, the present situation, and I say, what early life situation does this or this person represent? What does it remind you of? And they always say, oh, well, when I was five, you know, I was in kindergarten and this happened. We then go and use EFT on that early memory, and suddenly, once that's resolved, the boss, the husband, the wife, the teenage son, the teenage daughter, whatever it is they're reacting to now, no longer bothers them. But until you find that early memory, that early trauma, you can do a ton of work on your current issues, and they tend not to go away, because what they are is they're just reactivating. It's just that the boss now looks like the same person you've got buried in your trauma capsule. So when your boss says things in a tone of voice or says a certain word that resembles the imprint you have in your trauma capsule, that your trauma capsule leaks, the trauma capsule reminds you of that, you then spend all this energy and effort trying to fix the boss. But what it really is that buried trauma capsule, and it just so happens that this person in your current life has arrived on the scene to remind you of this unfinished emotional business from your childhood, and once you go ahead and fix that, suddenly all the later similar incidents resolve themselves spontaneously.
Yeah.
And I also feel that we are by nature optimistic, and that I think the pessimism comes in from the experiences of our lives and all these trauma capsules. So once the energy field is cleared, we can return to the way we naturally are, which is optimistic.
Ah, beautiful. I think, let's see, we have another caller here. Hello, this is 770. Who is this? Is this Susan?
Hi, Andrea. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. You're joining the discussion here.
I am.
Is that Susan Kolb?
Yes. Hi.
Hey, Susan. It's Stephanie.
Hey, Stephanie.
Yeah. So how are you this evening?
Well, I've got enough energy to do the show. That's good. 8:15. No, I just finished my own radio show. We were pre-recording, so worked out well.
Oh, good, good, good.
Well, you better have enough energy, Susan, because the name of your chapter is Energy Management.
Right.
A blueprint for optimism, so let's hear.
Well, it's all started because I guess I tried to do a lot more than I probably could without becoming a specialist in energy management. And actually, I'd had an interest in this topic for some time. Being in the Air Force, being a surgeon, being very, very busy, and yet also doing a radio show and having writing books and having many different hats to wear, as some of you know, it became important to manage energy so that I could do all of these things and not take a toll on my physical health. So I started to study energy management, and that's why I wrote it. I was very interested in writing the chapter because it's something I was doing for a long time. And if you're pessimistic, if you see the glass as half empty and are always seeing the negative side of things, energy management is very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I'm amazed at all the stuff that you do.
Why is energy management difficult if you're pessimistic?
I think it's because you don't have the resources to make it through the times that are more difficult. you tend to turn within instead of being able to get through the hard times. You know, life is not all roses, as we all know. And so how we handle ourselves in times of, you know, when say our parents die or become ill, we lose a spouse, we might lose a child. All of these things happen in life. Hopefully not all at once, but sometimes all at once. So one of the things you learn in spirituality is that you can't really control what happens to you, because that's probably determined by soul contracts and what you decide to, you know, to go through in order to gain spiritual growth. But you certainly can decide how much energy you're going to expend once certain things happen to you. And so having a viewpoint whereby you take advice from your higher self, higher wisdom, whatever you want to call it, your intuition, which often will warn you about things that are coming, and then being able to set out on a course so that you don't waste energy. And wasting energy is in regret, looking in the past. Some people live in the past with lots of regret. Other people fear the future. And other people just worry themselves all the time. And I'm of the opinion that you're given a certain amount of energy every day, which I guess in the Bible that was called your daily bread. And what you do with it is up to you. You know, that's why Eckhart Tolle and other teachers have taught us to stay in the now rather than live in the future or the past, and manage our energy. One thing that I found very helpful in my own life was try not to do anything for more than 4 hours. I would operate in the morning, see patients in the afternoon, do administrative work till about 7, and then from about usually 7:30 till midnight, that was the time I got called to the ER to work, and then I would try to sleep for 4 or 5 hours after that. So if you could do just things for no longer than 4 hours, you could do a lot more, and that doesn't fit in real well with our 8-hour work day. But sometimes when you have a lot of different jobs to do, you can limit it to 4 hours at a time. And that advice actually came from William James. You might have heard of him. He was a spiritually based psychologist.
Well, and I think it's safe to say that pessimism is draining and optimism feeds your energy.
Oh, yeah, for yes. Sure. Yeah, it's not even worth it to be pessimistic.
I don't think there could be anybody that says optimism actually gives them, pessimism actually gives them more energy.
No, I think it makes you more tired. It makes you depressed, really. You're basically hopeless, pretty much, wouldn't you say?
I think pessimistic people tend to focus on a negative outcome. I mean, they'll decide that, you know, something's not going to work, or this is going to be terrible, or, you know, the movie they're going to is going to be horrible. And then they project that onto wherever they're projecting, and then, of course, because they have the energy of creativity, they usually create that projection. So, I mean, you could, if you put enough energy into anything, you can really tip the odds that it's going to happen.
Well, and the other part of that that I heard from various people while I was working on this book was that there is a kind of a protective device that goes with pessimism. And this is what I heard from people, that, well, if I'm pessimistic, then I won't be disappointed.
Right.
So the idea that if you're optimistic, your hopes are going to get dashed. You're going to end up being disappointed because it's not going to come true, whatever it is that you're hoping for. And so it's an interesting mechanism, the idea of protect yourself by not even wanting it.
Interesting. But afraid, if you're pessimistic, you're afraid. You're afraid to do anything. And what kind of life is that, you know, to be afraid of moving?
I think it's better not to have expectations, though. I mean, can you go through life without having really hard set expectations of the future? I mean, I think you can.
Right, and so that's all about, I believe that everything is going to turn out great. I just don't know how it's going to turn out.
Right.
So it's like,
well, actually,
detaching from outcome, right?
Right, yeah, detaching from, yeah, that's a good way to put it, detaching from outcome. And being in the moment, you're kind of doing, you know, going with the flow and being positive and moving forward, but detaching yourself from the outcome.
And remembering what powerful creators we are. I mean, everything starts in a thought field. And, you know, being in body allows us to transmute that into matter. And if we continue to bring that energy through and expect a positive outcome, and yet still, you know, not be disappointed, but much better to focus on a positive outcome than to always expect the negative, because that's what will be created.
But, you know, it's funny, even though we talked about being in the moment, when you look back on your life experiences, things that didn't work out the way you had wanted them to, it usually worked out for the best. It's like, oh, I'm so glad that didn't happen the way I wanted it. Because if it did, do you know what I mean?
You have to not be very judgmental about what happens. In other words, you know, you kind of have to look on your life as an observer. And then when something unexpected happens, say, you know, somebody dies unexpectedly, or, you know, you get fired from a job unexpectedly, I think you're much better off asking higher guidance why this happened and what is a better course than the one you were on. And in my own experience, you're guided. It's better that you're fired from the job. You see, it's actually really good that you were, because I was fired from a job. It was really funny. I was driving to work one day, and I heard very clearly that something really bad was going to happen that day. And, of course, I heard, I don't want to know about it. You know, I just, I don't want to know about it. I'm staying in the now. I don't want to know what's going to happen. Well, I get to work, and they fire me. And that was really a blessing, because then I went on to start my own practice, and that was very necessary. And, I mean, I couldn't be in another group of plastic surgeons. I had to be on my own and start my own group. It was very necessary for the mission I was on. But, you know, the idea is that things will happen, and like you said, when you look back, they absolutely had to happen that way for you to get where you were going. So, you know, being non-judgmental is really important.
And to be okay with not having to know in the now, you know, to expect that being fired at that moment, maybe you didn't have that leapfrog to know that at that moment, oh, I'm going to go start my own practice and create something that's never been before with a different perspective.
Right.
But to be okay with, okay, I don't get it right now, but I trust in the higher power and the contract that you have coming in.
Yeah.
If this has
yeah.
to happen now, I get to step off the abyss into the unknowing just to be cradled, you know, in the blanket of finding out later on what that meant.
Yeah, and you know, the excuse that they gave me for firing me is that I wasn't making enough money, but I was making twice the money that they were making. So, you know, I mean, when it's just completely nonsensical, and that's what that was, then you know that there's other forces at play. You know, that you need to look deeper, so to speak.
That were in our highest and best good at the time.
Right, right. And I was warned about it before it happened, which is often, you know, something that happens that directs us to the fact that this is in divine order, because we are being warned about it. You know, it's not something, when I fell and broke my arm, I had no warning about it. You know, I was never warned about that. But you see, it's very interesting sometimes.
But even like with accidents and things like that, sometimes it happens just to force you to rest.
That's what happened with my broken arm.
Right. You know, because sometimes you just, we won't rest until we do something like sprain an ankle. Then you're forced. to do it.
That's right. That's
it's like, you know,
we're
the divine is telling you.
Aren't we?
Yeah.
It's one of those universal stop signs. You cannot get past.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Right.
That's yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, learning to rest. Yeah, these are beautiful sharings. And I think we're expecting a couple more callers.
I think Pamela's due at 8:30.
Yep, Pamela's at 8:30, and Holly is at 8:45.
Hey.
Yeah.
So many healers, it strikes me. It's so wonderful. All the healers.
Yeah. Do you think we all are have it in us to be healers? I mean, whether we end up being nurses or doctors, I mean, we certainly can heal others just by being optimistic and positive, don't you think? Or kind.
I think it absolutely goes, you know, with the job description. You cannot be somebody who's looking at the world in a negative way and expect to have any kind of positive outcome with those who come seeking your assistance. It just can't happen. The energy's not there. You know, you've got to be pulling it in and giving it out and acting as a beam of light, because those who are coming are depleted. You know, they're in a pessimistic place. Many of the patients I see have been to 14 other doctors, and they've been told that, you know, there is nothing that can be done for them. And by that time, they believe it. So, you know, to be able to take them from that place and guide them through a process of possibly proper diagnosis or seeing an illness through a different perspective, which allows them to see the gift in whatever it is that's ailing them, to turn it around rather than a deficit, and what they're learning from it and how it's transforming them and how it's a moment of metamorphosis in their life that allows them to take a different look at themselves and their situation and their relationships, and sort of be free of a work situation, or allows them to see themselves in a completely new way, and ask those questions. What do I want to do now? You know, having that freedom to recreate in the midst of their life, rather than losing their job because they can't do their duties anymore because of their physical condition or their illness. It's really a beautiful time of transformation and metamorphosis. And oftentimes I see in the process of their letting go of what was that wasn't serving them anymore, asks them to recreate, and they do. And they become like kids again. You know, what do I want to do when I grow up? How do I want my life to be? And they start moving in that direction rather than the safety and the drudgery of what became familiar.
Have you ever been in a situation, and everyone could share, where you're like, wow, how could this person be so optimistic? You know, where do they get that from? Have you ever met someone who just seemed to be going through such challenging times, but yet they remain so positive? And
I had a patient in the military who was a pilot, and he and his squadron went to Spain and had oysters, and they all got hepatitis, but he got primary biliary cirrhosis. And we used to round on him every day, and he was getting worse and worse, and we eventually ended up having him transferred for a liver transplant. But he knew he wasn't going to make it. He had this internal knowing, and every day when we came to round on him, he'd tell us jokes. I mean, he could hardly speak, but he would tell us jokes. And he once said, Wilford Hall is like the Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave. That guy was amazing.
Yeah.
And I also think it's really important that another thing that I encountered when I was doing this book is people think that optimism, it relates back to the discussion we were just having about the judgments on what happens in one's life. People people's attitude about optimism, some people that I encountered, was that, well, that meant that you believe that only good things are going to happen in your life, and so how could that possibly be? But I really think it's important to say this is not like, you know, some kind of utopia that we're trying to create with optimism. It's really about that reframing, as several people have talked about, where you look at what happens in your life, that there is good in all of it. There was a lesson that you needed to learn from being so ill or from breaking your arm or whatever it was, and that it's the way that you look at life that informs how you're going to respond to the challenges that come up in everyone's lives.
Right. And the thing is, we can always choose how we look at it. We can look at it negatively, or we can look at it positively and say it's a lesson. It's a lesson being presented here. And what is the lesson? And learn the lesson and move on.
And again, in terms of the most optimistic person, I would have to return to Helen Keller. I mean, that she is such a shining example of that for me.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, that actually is perfect, actually. I was just looking here, and I wanted to maybe read something that she said, because her sharings are so beautiful. And what I like is the title, Within. Let's see. Yeah, Helen Keller says, could we choose our environment, and were desire in human undertakings synonymous with endowment, all men would, I suppose, be optimists. Certainly most of us regard happiness as the proper end of all earthly enterprise. The will to be happy animates alike the philosopher, the prince, and the chimney sweep. No matter how dull or how mean or how wise a man is, he feels that happiness is his indisputable right. It is curious to observe what different ideals of happiness people cherish, and in what singular places they look for this wellspring of their life. Many look for it in the hoarding of riches, some in the pride of power, and others in the achievements of art and literature. A few seek it in the exploration of their own minds or in the search for knowledge. Most people measure their happiness in terms of physical pleasure and material possession. Could they win some visible goal which they have set on the horizon, how happy they would be. Lacking this gift or that circumstance, they would be miserable. If happiness is to be so measured, I, who cannot hear or see, have every reason to sit in a coma with folded hands and weep. If I am happy in spite of my deprivations, if my happiness is so deep that it is a faith so thoughtful that it becomes a philosophy of life, if, in short, I am an optimist, my testimony to the creed of optimism is worth hearing. As sinners stand up in meeting, and testify to the goodness of God, so one who is called afflicted may rise up in gladness of conviction and testify to the goodness of life. Wow.
That's great.
Yes, powerful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, she was a very evolved being who came to, you know, be a leader, and she was.
And it was the optimism.
Yeah, she ends her paragraph with, "This is my religion of optimism."
Yeah.
It'd be good to have a religion of optimism.
I think so. Yeah, it really is an inner, it's so deeply, you know, deep within. It's not something on the outside. It's really something deep within that you have to work on. And it does take some work to be positive.
It does. It takes work in knowing yourself. I think we're all here to at least master a certain amount of self-knowledge in each lifetime. And certainly happiness is an inside job. I mean, if you're looking for the relationship to make you happy, the job to make you happy, the bank account to make you happy, those things come and go. Sometimes, you know, many times during a lifetime, up and down, up and down, up and down. It's best not to hold on to any of the things external to you to define your happiness. So, but you learn, you know, you learn to not put expectations outside of yourself, but to be happy despite being ill, be happy despite being broke, and, you know, be happy when your relationships are falling apart.
Yeah. And the song says,
sometimes
don't worry.
I'm real happy when some of my relationships fall apart. Just a ticket.
My goodness. Well, don't worry, just be happy, right?
That's right.
The song says, don't worry, just be happy. Oh, wow.
I think what Stephanie mentioned about also dropping and recognizing that you're carrying things that may not be yours, to leave space for holding ever-increasing amounts of optimism is important, because a lot of people are wrestling, and that was something that I found, that some people are natural optimists, some people are, quote, natural pessimists. Then you have the majority of people that kind of dance in between. There are certain areas where you can be really great at being an optimist, and there's a few other areas that can just bring you to your knees. And I think it's important to recognize that you may have inherited something, or even like Dawson said, have a childhood memory that's triggering something else, and so that your responses aren't really from what's going on, but from what's still stuck in your system.
Yeah.
Use those techniques so that you can be more than 55% optimistic, and that helps you then reach towards being, you know, 70, 80, 90%.
And certainly it's important to be around optimistic people as well,
don't
you think, to help kind of cheer you on.
Yes, to see how they think and respond too, because, again, we're all brought up with certain environments, certain even regional ways of managing things, and we might not recognize that the style we're carrying is actually counterproductive. And so when you can see someone else handle it in a much different way, that gives you new tools and new opportunities too.
Susan, I think you raised a good point there about what an energetic legacy, if we want to call it that, that what you might have come in with. Not only might you be carrying things in this lifetime, but you might have come in with something from your lineage, or we don't even have to talk about past lives, but that could be another source. But I'm referring to the work of Bert Hellinger, the constellation, the family constellation idea, and he talks about the energetic legacy from an unresolved conflict in the family regarding one family member, that unresolved conflict carrying in the energetic legacy of the family down through generations. So something that happened back to your great-grandfather that was unresolved, and usually Bert Hellinger talks about it. He's a German psychotherapist, psychologist, and he talks about it as a either an omission, the family rejected this family member, or there was something terrible he did that everybody's ashamed about or feels guilty over, something like that. That there's a way that that person kind of got written out of the family, and then that can transfer down through the generations to emerge as addiction or asthma or almost anything in a descendant of that original family.
Yeah, that's something. We have another caller.
So you're carrying that, and you can't be optimistic.
Yeah, we have another caller. Let's see who it is. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
It's Holly Thompson.
Well, hello there. How are you?
I'm very well. Nice to be here.
Hi, Holly. Welcome.
Hi, how are you, Stephanie?
I'm good, thank you. Good to hear your voice again.
Great, thanks. It's great to hear yours.
Yeah, we're having this wonderful discussion on optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And Holly, I hope you'd be willing to share your story because it's really a story of healing, personal healing.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want me to start at the beginning or?
Well, I think people, listeners, would love to hear because this, to me, is an emergence in coming back to optimism through a serious physical issues.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd love to do that. Well, I, you know, as I had talked to you about Stephanie, as I wrote about, well, I had a career before my current career. I'm a health and nutrition coach. I'm the founder of NutritionalStyle.com. And when I lived in New York City, and I had a big career as a vice president for Chanel, and I did a lot of travel, and, you know, life was very exciting and everything you think it might be. And I left New York after I married someone who lived in Virginia, and basically my health began to deteriorate. It began to fall apart, and I started to develop several autoimmune issues, and what I now refer to as early warning signs. You know, nothing that was, you know, emergency room or, but just little, all these little things started to emerge that piled on top of each other actually became, you know, what I would refer to as a health crisis. And it began with, you know, allergies, a migraine headache cycle, that morphed into infertility, into several miscarriages, into hormone imbalance, into pain points of fibromyalgia, and another autoimmune issue, some appearances the autoimmune issue where basically your immune system is fighting you, rheumatoid arthritis, sorry. And then, you know, having lost several pregnancies and we went through IVF, and then that basically served to further, you know, mess up my hormones. And before you know it, when we finally decided to adopt, which was a wonderful and joyous thing, and still is, of course, you know, and found my one true son in Russia. The year I brought him home, I broke into a viral rash all over my body, and it was mononucleosis. So it was sort of the, you know, the capper on all of this, and it was several years that all of these different things were going wrong. And I explained in the book Optimism, it, you know, I kept going through all of it. I never once felt as though this is my fate, you know, this is my destiny. I'm meant to be a sickly person, and you know, I'm just going to be dealing with this the rest of my life. I never once felt that. I always felt, and I guess I always knew that this was temporary, and that I would resolve this, I'd figure this out. But what happened was, you know, life kept getting in the way, you know, and things kept piling up. And so finally my day of reckoning was when I was started getting sinus infections, and the finally had 7 in 1 year where I was basically living on antibiotics. I felt better on an antibiotic than I did without one. And by this point, I was taking a fistful of medications. I was on an antidepressant. I was on migraine medicine. I was on allergy medicine. I was on several different, you know, like nasal spray and sinus medication, and, you know, just you name it. And then I was living on antibiotics, as I mentioned. So finally, I went out to an event, and I remember heading out of, you know, leaving my house, and it was, I finally, like, didn't have a migraine, didn't have, you know, what had just gotten over another sinus infection. And a friend of mine looked at me and said, "Wow, oh my gosh, you're out, you know, it's great to see you. And how are you doing? Like, you're sick all the time, aren't you?" And there was something about the way she said that, because as I said, I never really stopped to think that this is my life, you know, I'm a sickly person. And there was something about the way that she said that that really flattened me. And she said, have you ever considered that your immunity is really compromised? And that scared me. It just, you know, it scared me because I hadn't. I really hadn't. I was going through it all. And I was a new mom, and I had this bouncing, healthy baby boy. And, you know, and I was in a marriage that I loved. And, you know, and life otherwise was really good. So after that was really, truly my day of reckoning. I began to call all different holistic practitioners that I had heard about, but I had kept track of. In this journey, we're knowing, like, you know, someday I'm going to go see that nutritionist because I think that could really help me, or someday I need to go and see this acupuncturist because I've heard that can really work for migraines. And so I had acquired a list, and the very next day I reached out and I began a path that lasted a few years. It was not a quick and easy one-stop shopping fix by any means. It was a trial and error. It was an investigation. It was a learning process that I went through. It was me going back to my nutrition books, back to my health books that I had always been passionate about my entire life. And it was a journey, a step-by-step, baby-step-by-baby-step approach to my health where when I discovered something, it stuck. As I added in more phytonutrients and antioxidants and, you know, raw vegetables and green smoothies and you know, all of these different things that I incorporate into my diet and different superfoods and my, you know, my different concoctions, you know, one of my doctors called them my home remedies, they stuck. But it wasn't an overnight. It wasn't overnight, and that's very much the way that I work with clients now. I think a lot of people are really looking for a quick fix, and they look for it in a pill. And I understand that because, obviously, modern medicine is a wonderful thing. But when you are looking to fix your problems, it's, you know, often with medication, you're masking what's going on. You are curing a symptom rather than the cause. And if you don't get to the root cause of what created it in the first place, it's going to lead to other issues. You know, we're talking holistic health, meaning anything we do in our lives, in our body, it's all connected. So part of what I did was get to the root cause of my issues. And I discovered some foods that were creating this inflammation. And the inflammation was what was creating the migraines and the sinus and the mucus and the, you know, all of the other issues that then spiraled from this. And a lot of studies now are showing that inflammation is at the root cause of many much more serious diseases in our country. So this was my path, and discovering what was the root cause of my issues was the key for me to remove certain foods, to remove certain food groups, and to add in copious amounts of healthy, you know, life-enforcing vegetables, and other foods. And it was after that that I realized, you know what, this is my calling. This is my path. People need to know about this. People need to understand this because I know a lot of people who are dealing with one or more of some of those ailments that I was dealing with. You know, I have friends who are getting chronic sinus infections. I know women who get constant migraines. You know, one of my sisters had fibromyalgia and some other different issues that were very similar to mine. And so I decided I needed to help spread the word and share this with women and work with women so that they get that it's not going to happen overnight, and what works for your best friend might not work for you. That's the key. There has to be an investigative journey in there to discover what's right for you as an individual, and it's not necessarily what works for your sister or for your best friend.
Wow, that's an amazing story.
What struck me about it, Holly, was that you didn't go into despair during this incredible healing journey where you felt so terrible and were so completely exhausted most of the time.
I know. But you didn't give in to it.
She didn't give in. And I'm thinking about what you said about the friend who said, "You're so sick," you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you said it is like you didn't really think of yourself really as being sick when you were going through this, did you?
No, I really didn't. I mean, that was the, you know, call it crazy, but that I never once thought, oh, I'm such a sickly person. It was just the way my life was then, and I knew I would figure it out, but I needed to, you know, before you can figure things out, you need to begin feeling stronger, and you often need to be in a healthier place. It's tough. I mean, you know, like simply put, it's almost like when you have a terrible cold and you just can't get out of bed to go get, you know, the aspirin or, you know, the Tylenol because your head hurts so bad. You know, like it's that kind of, that's what happens to a lot of people when they go through this. And so I knew that I would figure it out somehow. My husband knew I would figure it out. You know, thank God. I mean, I had a happy marriage. I was fairly newly married, and we were happy. And when it was a good day, meaning like when it was a good, you know, a good week where I was healthy and could go out, you know, we were having fun, but it was very up and down. It was very up and down, and it was tough because I had a new baby. But it was interesting. The way she said that to me, I was almost embarrassed. You know, it just made me feel badly. Like, wow, I don't want people to think that about me. That's not me. That's not my identity. I'm not owning that. And if that's what's happening, isn't that interesting? Like if, you know, then someone else says it to you. Like, if that's how I'm being viewed, I need to change that. You know, and it was enough. It served as a little fire under me to get me to really, really begin. And as I said, I mean, that was the turning point, but it didn't resolve fast. I mean, there were many bumps in the road after that.
Yeah, it's like you just kept moving forward.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story. And you are very optimistic because you kept saying, you know, oh, I'm going to fix this.
Right. I know. I don't know why. I think, looking back and looking at my business that I've created and the people that I have been able to help and the service that I have been able to be of to these, you know, hundreds of women now and some men, hundreds and hundreds of people by now. And so when I look back at that time, I'm now so grateful for it. And if I hadn't gone through that, I would never have discovered my second career. I would never be able to help the people that I've helped, and I wouldn't be fulfilling my purpose in the world. I would still be wondering what was my true purpose, what was my calling. And when I worked at Chanel as a vice president, it was fun, it was glamorous, it was glorious, but I knew in my heart that I wasn't meant to sell million-dollar necklaces to rich ladies for the rest of my life. You know, I knew that there was more that I was supposed to bring to the party, and nothing against selling million-dollar necklaces to rich ladies, because there are a lot of wonderful, you know, wonderful, heartfelt women who can afford to buy things like that, and there are fabulous people who are doing the selling and the creating. And so it's not against that. It is that I knew that there was something else that I was supposed to be bringing forth, and it wasn't in the working like that with people. It was more direct. It was helping people. Heal, was helping people find their way. It was empowering women, and that's really what I do. And I empower women to stand up for themselves and stand up for their own health and to take control of it and figure out what's going on, you know, and I help them do that. I hold their hand and we figure it out. It's like a puzzle. It's like a puzzle. And not once in my journey of all of those years and many different doctors did any doctor ever ask me, what do you eat? Not once.
Really?
And that was the key, and I guarantee you it is the key question for many, you know, many people on this planet that are going through different health issues. By saying to someone, what do you eat? And let's talk about your food. Because everything that goes into your body, it's either for your good or not. It's one way or the other. And so if you are spend your day eating food that is not for your good, then it is going to create inflammation and blockages and various issues that are going to manifest in certain tiny ways when you're in your 20s and then 30s. And then by the time you're in possibly your late 30s or your 40s or your 50s or your 60s or your 70s, it's coming out in big ways the older you get because your body's been at battle for you for now decades, right?
Yeah.
So I often see that too, that, you know, as I call it, an early warning sign when you're 35, by the time you're 48 or 54, it's no longer an early warning sign. It's now a form of disease in your body, and you've most likely been given a pill for it.
Well, Holly, your story also brings up for me one of the ingredients of optimism, which is I think that people are better able to be optimistic about life in general when they have a sense of meaning and purpose. So your path led you to what gives you meaning and purpose, and I think that just it's like an upward spiral where you can be more feel more positively about the world when you are in touch with your own meaning and purpose on the planet.
Right. I agree with that, Stephanie. It's very much pulling forward. You know,
yeah.
That not saying everything is always perfect. That's not what this means at all. But it does mean that even when you go, when you go through the bad times and you go through the challenges, if you realize that that something is pulling you, that you do have a purpose, that you have, you know, you are going to be able to be of service along the way and that you are needed in some way or that you know you can help someone in some way, then it helps pull you out, you know, it helps keep you moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's another ingredient, being of service.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working on the Audacious Aging Anthology, and I've encountered this with different elders I've known over the years, and there's a common theme in there that to age audaciously, part of that is about feeling of service, being of service and feeling that you are needed. And
yeah.
And it's so important for people of all ages to feel needed and doing service. But I think it's especially important after you get through the complications of early life where you're trying to figure out how to make your way in the world, and so being of service, say, in your 20s is not as important as it is when you get through the so-called householder stage of life and you're on into your 50s and 60s and beyond, and I think then you're in a much better position to be of service because you know who you are, you've done a lot of exploration, you've been through a lot of things, you have a lot of wisdom to offer. I think people can be of service at any age, but it seems to become more important to people to feel that they are of service in the later years of life.
I was going to say we often see that in tribal communities where where the elders or women that are past the childbearing years, their role becomes they become the leaders. They become the nurturers and the guides and the wise women.
Mm-hmm.
And that you see that all over the world. it's part of who we are. And in our, you know, maybe in our country, we don't really recognize it, or we're beginning to recognize that role again.
And I think the other thing is that people of all, of any age, all ages, to feel a sense of right livelihood, that you've really found your niche, you've found what gives you joy, you know, the work that gives you joy, the work in the world that gives you joy, and whether it, you're feeling of service or not, that might not be the issue, but this feeling of right livelihood, that you're really on the path that you're supposed to be, that I think also increases your ability to be optimistic, because
right.
You've fallen into place.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, what a beautiful sharing. Thank you for that. I think we have another caller. Let's see who this is. Hello.
Hi, it's Joey Adler.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good. How are you? I was just very interested in listening to the previous conversation. Very, very nice.
Hi, yeah. Joey. It's Stephanie.
Hi, Stephanie. How are you?
I'm great. How about you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful discussion. Holly, did you have anything else that you wanted to share at all? Hello? Hello?
It's only me that's on now. It's Joey.
That's strange. Oh. okay.
Joey, I was just looking at your, I'm sitting here with your picture in front of me of your chapter in the book, and I was remembering, I love this line that you have in your second paragraph where you say, some of us indulge in a bit of magical thinking. We assume that if we faced tragedy once and survived, we are immune from it the rest of our lives, as if inoculated against a rare virus. Wrong. Lightning can strike twice and can, in fact, strike many times. This is kind of what we were talking about earlier. I would love it if you would share what that was about for you.
Well, I mean, my late husband, you know, got cancer in 1990, and we got through that. You know, that was kind of a long and protracted story, which would take probably a long time for me to say, but irrespective, for me, it was like, okay, that's it. You know, we've faced our dilemma, and, someone can't possibly get cancer twice, you know, and they can't get a different cancer. Well, the reality is the likelihood is that it's an insidious disease, and in my mind, it was just not possible that we would have to face any other issues. And from that, you know, from the treatment came heart issues, and then from the heart, you know, it was just like this roller coaster of problems and just fighting for survival. And then, you know, this past year, my dad, you know, 18 months ago contracted cancer. And I said to myself, like, life is just not, I don't know if it's us that sometimes don't really want to face reality, or if you're an optimist maybe, then that's also, you know, has a double-edged sword where you're like, well, you know, I've done my penance and I'm, you know, I can move on, you know, with a clear road ahead in life, and it just doesn't work like that. And as we all know, I'm sure everyone listening to this conversation, I don't think anyone's immune from the fact that lightning strikes multiple times for many people, and it's sometimes very, very, very hard to accept that. And like I was saying to a friend of mine yesterday who just turned 80 years old, she's a woman that started, one of the first people in the world to start a cancer support program 33 years ago. She's been, you know, touted across the world, and her husband's been very sick, and, you know, it's 40 years that he's gone from problem to problem, and she lost her leg at 15 of cancer. So as a couple, they've sacrificed their whole life helping others. And, you know, and she turned to me and said, well, it's just not fair. And I looked at her and I thought, Sheila, you know it's not fair, but it's life. And if you ask that question, why, you never get an answer. So it's best to just, I looked at it as like a card game all the time. I said, I've been dealt a hand of cards, and I'm just going to play it out as best as I can.
And was it hard for you to emerge from that with a sense of optimism?
know I've always been an optimist, and I think that in fact, what I went through, the struggle that I went through, the disaster with my husband, actually made me more of an optimist, because, you know, they had him dead 2 days into the process, and we were able to get through that and live an extraordinary moment in time, albeit a short one, and it made me understand that with the power of positive thinking and the confidence of optimism, you can push the envelope as far as you can possibly push it. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, it does make sense. It's beautiful.
And then I just want to give a bow to the philanthropic work that you do, because it truly is incredible, the contribution that you're making to the world. And I would love it if you talk about one by one.
Sure. I mean, you know, it started exactly from that, from what I went through with my late husband, this understanding, this full realization that there was really not a whole lot of value for one life. And I really did promise myself that, you know, I would spend the rest of my life promoting the value of one by one. And so the philosophy of one by one is exactly that. It's the that every single life is precious, and that as an individual you can make a profound difference in the life of others. I like to say that I believe in the power of one, but I also know that many ones together collaborating are exponentially powerful. And we concentrate on children in the United States, Canada, and around the world. And, you know, right now, every morning, it's the school year, and we're feeding about 4,000 kids in the Aboriginal communities of Canada, which is a real devastation. We're relaunching the U.S. Foundation on October the 10th in New York. We have a lot of projects in Haiti and Africa. And we're a small, relatively very small organization, but we pack a mean punch. We like to say we box above our weight.
You also pack a mean lunch, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, actually, yeah, you know, the truth of the matter is, you know, we have 22 million children in North America that are food insecure. Mm-hmm. And it's really a devastating problem that I think a lot of people don't. You know, I was with a friend of mine who's a CEO of a major, major, major worldwide corporation. I was having lunch with him last week, and I said, look, you've got to get on this bandwagon with me and help promote this idea of, because in the United States, you guys are really amazing because you have lunch and breakfast programs in all your public schools. You spend about $500 per child per school year in the public schools. In Canada, we don't have any. We have zero, which is really weird when you think about it, because, you know, we're this great example of fiscal responsibility and whatnot, but we just don't have it.
And we usually think of you as being ahead of us in terms of those community-type programs.
No, on this one we're so far behind, it's actually very scary. Mm. And so I was saying to him, you know, we got to get, he goes, what are you talking about? And this is an extremely educated, very high, I said to him, I'm telling you, there's probably a couple of million children in Canada that are food insecure. I had to spend the whole lunch convincing him. He was actually sending an email to someone in Ottawa that he knew in the government to ask if I was right.
Wow.
And so I think there's a lot of people that just don't know how critical this issue is. And in the States, you're actually moving the envelope more towards, okay, we have lunch programs, but how do we make them healthy? But that's the next step. We're just trying to find ways of how to get children not to be hungry because they can't learn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big thing for me. And then, of course, our hospital, our pediatric ward in the hospital in Mirabalais, state-of-the-art hospital in Haiti, which we're very proud of, that we committed $3 million to Paul Farmer Partners in Health, which is one of the best organizations, if not the best organization in the world. So we're very proud. Like I said, we have big projects, and we like to concentrate where we can really make an impact.
And I want to make it clear that you're the founder of One by One, right? Yes?
Yes, I am. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your beautiful work.
Well, you know, I say it all the time now. You know, we flew 8 missions after the earthquake, and we were the first non-military flight into Haiti. And we flew 8 missions, and we took about, I don't know, maybe 500,000 kilos of medical equipment. And it taught me that those moments that helping another human being is not an obligation, but it is a very, very, very big privilege.
Yeah. One by one. Beautiful.
Thank you.
We have a couple of other callers. I'm just going to open up both lines here. Two more callers. Hello? Hello?
Hi, this is Pamela.
Hi there, Pamela. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Is that Pamela Weibel? We have Pamela Smith joining us, too.
Yeah,
Pamela
Smith
Weibel. Is here as well.
Hey, Dr. Weibel, how are you?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
I'm good.
Okay, did I hear? There's another voice there, too. Pamela Smith, are you there?
I am.
Oh, great. So we're all here now.
So we have two more doctors.
Great. Wonderful. Pamela, you were in a storm, right?
Yeah, so it was a little crazy here, so I'm sorry I'm late. Sorry about that.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for calling in. I don't know, Pamela Smith, are you on a time schedule? Did you want to share first?
Sure.
Yeah, please, if you don't mind, Pamela.
If that works for everybody.
No,
does
I don't
it?
Mind.
Okay.
Does that work for everybody?
Yes.
Yep.
Excellent.
If you would just share with us your first response to the Optimism book.
It is truly fabulous. And everybody that has come into contact with this book, it's amazing looking at what everybody has to offer and the idea of being happy, helping others, extending lifespan, all the things that are discussed here. Everyone that has bought it that I know of has found it to be a useful and positive book in their life.
Right. So if you could just share with us some of your experiences with optimism, you know, in your own life, your work, or what you've observed in others and why it's so important, and how do you remain optimistic during challenging times?
Well, certainly I think the field of medicine, and I'm a medical doctor, is really the most cherished field in the world when it comes to optimism in 2012. We have so much to offer patients now in the last 30 years in medicine that it has revolutionized what we have to do. We've gone from when I first finished med school over 30 years ago to the beginning of ultrasound and CAT scan and what we call protocol medicine, to now medicine is focusing on very much an individualized and customized approach. And certainly in my specialty of metabolic medicine, that is what we look at, is individualized care. And we can now treat the cause of the problem and not just look at symptoms. So we have much more to offer the patient. We do now, in an optimistic viewpoint too, have a lot to offer when it comes to prevention. An example. It used to be that we waited until someone had diabetes and we said, "Hi, you have diabetes." Now we can tell, in many cases, 10 years ahead of time that you're going down the road to diabetes, and we have a lot to offer now to intervene before the patient becomes diabetic. So a lot of optimism in medicine now.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that really is. Yeah, I guess, you know, we have come a long way, and then also there's so many natural remedies as well. You know, integrative medicine has come a long way, which is wonderful.
It has, and metabolic medicine is an integrative approach. And so we very much love conventional medicine and what it has to offer, but in a metabolic approach, we take traditional medicine and we have more tools in our armamentarium to add some what you might call natural things to what we're doing as well. So in that example of pre-diabetes, what we can do is we can have the person exercise, they can have a healthy diet, more fiber in their diet as well, but also adding things like chromium, which is a mineral, and alpha-lipoic acid, which is a nutrient. We can add those things to their regime, and it makes insulin work better in the body. And so we can actually help the body work a little bit better than it can on its own in some cases.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's really great. Well, thank you. Did you want to share anything else about optimism for our audience who'll be listening to this archive?
Well, certainly from the viewpoint of being optimistic, there's the glass half empty and the glass half full. But the good news from at least our field of looking at the idea of optimism, even if we have a disease process such as depression, which is not as optimistic, now we can help the patient with antidepressants, but we can also look at the cause of the problem. So it may be that, for example, a male or female, their hormones are low. That can cause depression. It may be that they have stress. So there's different things we can do to help people be optimistic, because even though they may have been born with a gene for a disease process, we now know 20% is inheritance and 80% is environmental. And so let's say you were born with a gene for depression or diabetes or Alzheimer's. Whether you go on to actually get the disease, many times is 80% up to the patient and the environment they choose to put their body in. So it's really optimistic, because you're not stuck with your genetic history. And this is fabulous news.
Yeah, that is fabulous. So there's really hope for the future, you know, even, you know, with the genetics and all, that there are things that you can do.
There is. So
yeah.
It's fabulous and very optimistic.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you for that sharing.
Thank you.
And Ms. Pamela Weibel there, how are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
You were so optimistic and upbeat.
That could be an understatement, but yeah, I am. And wait till you hear what's going on lately.
Well, please share with us.
Okay.
We know you're moving forward, though.
Oh, yeah, 100 miles an hour. I mean, in the optimism book, of course, I celebrate the fact that hospitals and clinics are being redesigned by their community, and people can really get, you know, individualized care that they design on their own, not even held hostage to a system that's been designed for them, which really puts the patient in the driver's seat for the first time. And so I have just taken this to the next level in the last year, where people are telling me all sorts of things they'd like to do during their office visits, and you know what? I welcome it. If you want to, for example, I had a woman in her 50s. She called me for an appointment, and she didn't have insurance, and I don't, you know, keep anyone, I don't limit my practice to people just with insurance. I make sure everyone has access to me no matter what they can pay. And so she asked me, you know, how much is it going to cost to come in? And I said, you know what, we'll do whatever you want, whatever works for you. And she said, well, can I bring my friend Teresa? And I was like, sure, bring all your friends. Well, you know what we did? She came in with her best friend, and we did their physicals together, uninsured, with balloons and party hats and streamers, and we made it into a big party. I call it a pat party. But, you know, that was designed by the patient, you know, to make them feel comfortable. People don't tend to want to be in, like, a scary, cold room in a paper gown. You know what I mean? And
right.
They tell me they would rather have balloons, party hats, their best friend next to them, flannel gown, and I just pretty much deliver what the patient wants. And it makes it really fun for me, too, you know, and we laugh the whole time. So I've had a number of people who've come in and they've laughed through their appointment, and we forget why they're even there. When we remember why they've come in for some sort of pain, they tell me the pain's gone away.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about the power of laughter. And, yeah. So you create this positive environment for your patients.
Yeah, I welcome them to create their own positive environment, and I'm receptive to what they ask me for. You know?
Right.
Like 2 weeks ago, I actually had a goat in my office.
I brought a
Stephanie
goat.
Would Stephanie would love that, right?
Okay, now this I have to hear about, Pamela, because you know I have a farm animal sanctuary, so tell me about the goat.
I know. Well, what happened, it's actually the title of my next book called Pet Goats and Pap Smears, and I allow people to bring their pets to their office visits with them, and I had several different people ask to bring a goat, and so I said, sure, and if you go to petgoatsandpapsmears.com and click on videos, you can see the goat wandering around my office with the four women getting their pap smears. It's really funny. I can't even explain how funny this is. I even made a stethoscope for the goat. I had to cut it shorter, you know what I mean, because their neck's shorter, and it's just so cute. It's the cover of my next book. It shows a goat in between a woman's legs getting the pap smear, and the goat sitting there looking at the camera wearing a stethoscope. Because what people have told me is that animals have such a healing impact in their life, and they really should be integrated into hospitals and clinics. And so that's why I'm willing to try anything once, even bring a farm animal into the clinic. It was really fun.
Well, you know, there's also a lot of research on the health benefits of having an animal companion, for example, but also what they call pet therapy, which is
right.
Or animal therapy, which is having taking animals into convalescent homes and hospitals to visit because it helps the healing.
Yeah,
and this
that's
goat,
really...
her name is... Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, tell us about the goat. We want to know.
The goat, her name is Charity, and she's actually a therapy goat from a petting zoo. There's 15 therapy goats there, and they help people with emotional issues. You know,
wow.
People bond with the animals. The woman who owns the animals is down the street from me. She originally got them because she's doing foster parenting and adoption and to help just kids heal their emotional wounds. And so now this goat comes into clinics and helps patients, and it's just so much fun. I can't even tell. We had a party hat on the goat. It was fun.
Oh, that's really great.
Oh,
that's beautiful. Yeah. And you should read Stephanie's book, What the Animals Taught Me.
I know.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I love it. Wow. It's just,
thank you, Andrea.
It's one of the most beautiful books I've ever read in my entire life.
Oh,
I mean, it's just absolutely, it's just beautiful. It was just so amazing.
You're going to make me cry.
Well, it's just, it made me want to cry. It was such a moving book, but, you know, it's just beautiful. And, you know, this whole project and is just optimism is so needed now. I mean, we always need optimism, but I have to tell you, when I look at the headlines, I'm like, ugh.
Yeah.
But it's so funny. When I booked this show, I said, I have a feeling that it's going to be the perfect time to talk about optimism because there are just so many people in need, you know, who need to have some light. And, you know, I was thinking about the group, it was Joey's group, the one-on-one.
One by one.
You know, one by one, we can all make a difference. And, you know, a small group, if we start out just spreading that optimism, you know, that light, that kindness, that warmth, then we can spread and help others, you know, to stay uplifted.
I think the subtitle of this book could be optimism, an antidote to despair.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the main problem, that when patients come to the doctor, it's not obesity or diabetes. The primary issue that I see is despair and boredom. If we can help patients with that, then I think the downwind problems, you know, that develop later in life can be ameliorated, because what people really are suffering from is a lack of meaning in their life and just a sense of despair. You know, which feeds all those destructive behaviors.
Well, we were talking about that earlier, about, you know, having a purpose. So it's important to, do something, you know, to be of service to others, because I think that gives more value, you know, to your life if you know that you're important to other people, that they do need you, if you know what I mean. They need, I don't know if I'm wording it correctly, but, you know, it's like we need each other. We're all connected. And
it sounds good to me. That sounds right on to me, Andrea.
Yeah.
I mean, we do. We need each other. So, you know.
Well, we need each other to model right. these behaviors, because fun and a joy is contagious, you know. And so
right.
how do we learn how to do it if not from somebody standing next to us and laughing and getting us to start laugh, you know, to start laughing and playing around. I think a lot of times what I notice is everyone's just waiting around for the first person to start having fun. And once the first person does it, everyone else wants to join in, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's true.
Andrea,
yeah.
I'm going to need to sign off.
I think we're all going to sign off now. Some people have left already, which is perfectly fine, but this has been just wonderful.
I want to thank you so much.
Yeah. And thanks for letting me jump in at the last minute here. Sorry.
Well, I'm glad you're safe, and I'm glad you were able to, you know, pop on, and it's always a pleasure hearing from you. And it's been just, all of the sharings have been just wonderful. The book is amazing, absolutely amazing. So thank you all for contributing to the book. And thank you, Stephanie and Dawson, for coming up with the idea.
Right, thank you for the inspiration.
And Andrea, could I give my website so people could look up my other books?
Oh, sure. You can give your web. Anyone can give their websites if they'd like to.
Mine is stephaniemarone.com. It's StephanieMarohn.com. And you can find out about my other books on there, too, and also my animal sanctuary and my animal healing work.
Right. And then, of course, everyone can go to the optimismbook.com website, correct?
Yes, optimismbook.com.
Correct. Well, it's been wonderful. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you, Andrea.
It's a real pleasure. I really love your work and your sharings in the book.
Thank you so much.
So now you got to do one on laughter.
it'll be infectious, that we know.
I know. That would be fun. All right. Take care, everyone. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. I would like to thank our guests, Dawson Church, Stephanie Marone, and all of the wonderful contributors who called in, for being here to discuss optimism, cultivating the magic quality that can extend your lifespan, boost your energy, and make you happy now. For more information, please visit www.optimismbook.com. To each and every one of you out there, thank you so much for joining me, Andrea Garrison, here online with Andrea. Make sure you join me next time here on Blog Talk Radio, the citizen's voice on the internet, taking radio to a new interactive and expansive level. But in the meantime, do whatever you can to reach out to help others. And never underestimate the power of a friendly smile. Thank you so much for listening to Andrea Garrison. Take care.
Thank you for connecting to Online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.